Hello, and welcome to The Learning College, put on by Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm your host, Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at myvnnforum.com, and later permanently archived at alexlinder.com. Today we're going to conclude Chapter 2 of James Mason's Siege with subsections 2.31 through 2.46. Let's dig in. 2.31, later on, will conspire. A comrade sent me a pamphlet issued by a bunch of idiots who happen to be the proud owners of some professional printing equipment and who thereby imagine themselves qualified to speak on the subject of revolution. In this pamphlet, they darkly talk in grave tones about conspiratorial activity. At that point, my suspicions of them, which I'd had since the mid-70s, were confirmed. They are children, playing with matches. The term conspiracy is not now and never has been part of my vocabulary. It is dangerous. I should say unnecessarily dangerous. For conspiracy means talk, and talk is counter-revolutionary. Talk is what the system and its pimps love most of all. In case you didn't know it already, you can do big federal time for merely conspiring to do something. You need not take any action, only talk about it to a circle of three or more, including yourself. And that constitutes conspiracy. And one of the favorites of the system is to charge people with, quote, conspiring to violate civil rights, which sometimes doesn't even require the discussion of any action. But of course, you figure that you are too careful for that, eh? You think that you know and can trust the people you deal with, right? Let me quickly relate the story of how two brothers were framed by the feds and who are now serving a 6-year term for conspiracy. A hired pimp was sent into their group in Columbus, Ohio, in 1977 to first gather information and later to act as an agent provocateur. He spent 2 years building his credibility before he began to get a little bold with his suggestions. It doesn't matter how tight your imagined security is if it includes one professional pimp. This agent kept bucking for some kind of action, something solid, as a strike against forced busing in Columbus. Finally, he got around to the idea of bombing a school. Then came the brothers' big mistake. They did not say to the pimp at that moment, "Get thee behind me." They listened. They discussed the pros and cons. And later, in the federal courtroom, after their arrests by an army of FBI agents, they saw and heard themselves, on widescreen motion picture, conspiring with police agents to bomb a school building. The all-white jury didn't even take 30 minutes to return a verdict of guilty. Rockwell in 1965 conjured up that exact scene of one day having to sit in a court of law and watch yourself on film. Well, gang, 1984 arrived a long time ago. This Big Brother system is held in power largely through pimps, both professional and amateur. Actually, it is a pimp system. A whole society of loose-lipped blabbermouths. Law enforcement would nearly shut down without its pimps, who are in most cases not even agents in the true sense, just babbling idiots. The professional hired pimps are one thing. Loose talk and stupidity are another. But they both lead to the same disastrous result. And they both are defeated the same way. Don't conspire, don't talk. In effect, it's only illegal to get caught, only illegal to trip up. You don't need to ever enter into a conspiracy. You don't need to ever deal with persons who might later let loose with fatal talk. We must have acts of revolution. The sooner the better, the more the merrier. But these are all of a nature that they can be and must be carried out by individuals. And that removes all requirement for talk, the possibility of conspiracy, and the danger of a leak. The lone wolf cannot be detected, cannot be prevented, and seldom can be traced. For his choice of targets, he needs little more than the daily newspaper for suggestions and tips galore. But it is necessary that NSLF begin again its program of systematic infiltration of the Reds, the unions, local Democrat and Republican cells, etc., even the local NAACP. You need not be colored to join. We do have need of privileged information and will have greater need in the future. For his training, the lone wolf needs only the U.S. military, or any one of 100 good manuals readily available through radical booksellers. Equipment is still easily available, and I caution against possessing illegal weapons as they aren't necessary. And even though the system may be expected to enact more anti-gun laws, this will only serve to stimulate an ever-growing black market for armaments, thus producing an ever greater pool of human resources for us to recruit from. His greatest concern must be to pick his target well, so that his act may speak so clearly for itself that no member of white America can mistake its message. If you can't do it, leave it alone. Forget it. Don't try and talk someone else into doing it, and especially don't hear of anyone else trying to talk you into anything. Don't talk, period. However, it can't hurt to begin now to learn, to train, and to have materials ready. That was Volume 9, Number 5, September 1980. 2.32. On the way into Poland in 1939, or more accurately, on the way back into the Polish-occupied German territory at the outset of World War II, Adolf Hitler told his troops, "Close your hearts to pity." A strange thing for a Nazi to be telling other Nazis. After all, that is supposed to be a foregone conclusion if we have been taught right. Didn't Hitler start the war for the pure fun and brutality of it? We know otherwise, but there is still a subtle message in what Hitler told his men in 1939. In spite of Polish occupation of German territory since 1918, and in spite of some of the worst outrages done against the German inhabitants by some overzealous Poles, Hitler knew he had to spell out plainly to his men what the mission was if it was going to be done right. It is part of the white man's makeup to forget, to know pity. It is found in no other race. And this trait has cost us plenty over the centuries because we have let so many enemies get away. As we all too painfully know, that was the prime reason for the loss of World War II. Hitler was not the bad guy he is made out to be. Had he been, the British army at Dunkirk would have been annihilated. Every Jew in Europe would have been killed, and idealism would not have been so high as to prevent the immediate use of millions of Russians and Ukrainians in the fight against Marxist-Leninism. But in a lot of respects, those German soldiers crashing their way back into their lost provinces had it a lot easier than we shall in closing our hearts to pity, for when an enemy is shooting at you, the instinct is to shoot back. And in the case of a war between European states, once the issue was settled on the field of honor, life could go on as before. Not so at all for the United States in the Civil War that is coming up. One well-known right-wing leader has already said that we must not neglect to assemble our own lists of enemy operatives and sympathizers in our own locales for quick reference later on. His argument, and he is correct, is that you know damn good and well that they certainly have us on their list in triplicate. On the surface, this isn't a bad idea, but I know how lazy the movement is. It is by no means wishful thinking for me to draw you this picture. Not many months ago, I had regular occasion to screen people in their homes in the line of work. Conversation invariably drifted to the topic of the neighborhood. More than once, I found myself standing in windows or yards being given a visual guided tour of where the race mixers lived. At those times, I could visualize myself in the same circumstances, only this time in official capacity as a revolutionary cleanup man, and that is part of how the Civil War is going to shape up. The real white Americans who are left, and there are many, hate the very sight of race mixing, even though they scarcely understand the larger genetic meaning of it. They hate those of their own race who are involved in it. Don't you think they'd love to come to us later on after this existing race-mixing system has been smashed down by revolution and finger every single race-mixer known to them, knowing fast action on our part will follow instantaneously? This sort of renders the need for lists unnecessary. As far as the system's kingpins are concerned, everybody knows who they are. As far as the system sucks are concerned, we know ours by heart very well, and you can and should be the same in your area. The truth is that assembling and keeping the so-called hit list for us at this time is a danger. Looks bad as hell in case of a raid, and it is unnecessary. Actual system bureaucrats will get it during the full-phase course of the revolution as we go about the real business of smashing the power of the system. The larger cleanup phase, during and after the Civil War, which even then will be raging, is a different matter. As most of you have long ago noticed, a lot of the most rabid, sneering miscegenators are blonde, blue-eyed doll babies. If you can't close your heart to pity, if you couldn't blast the head off one or a thousand of these types, then you had better bow out right now. War is war, and it is somehow highly impersonal. Or it is something highly impersonal. But white renegades, be they government officials or plain bleeding hearts, are another matter. We must swear an oath to ourselves, now, while we're down, while things are tough, while the enemy is in full power, while the vile race mixers daily promenade openly in public, protected by this evil system, now, while it is easy to hate, that for the United States there will be no need for concentration camps of any kind, for not a single transgressor will survive long enough to make it to that kind of haven. Volume 9, Number 6, October 1980. 2.33, Helter Skelter is coming down. But while membership and support for the traditional movement has just about died, look what has been born in the past year or so. To call it the movement or to call it the right would be a bad misnomer. From the forces favoring life itself, there has begun an assault, not just in the United States, but in Europe as well. Not more parliamentary garbage which plays by the master's rules, but armed assault. A few of the more aspiring attempts were frustrated, but as we have said, only because they were first, infant steps. Others will follow and will succeed. Those which have been the most uniformly successful have been the one-on-one, gut, animal-level encounters. Encounters one might well, only a few years ago, have ascribed as peculiar to the jungle. The system's Justice Department announced that it has 14 major U.S. metropolitan areas under surveillance by what is referred to as a community relations service. It means that one, at least, of the milestones we set for the scenario immediately preceding a revolution has arrived. When the system can no longer pay billions in tribute to the millions of savages in its cities, then we might look for some action. The means by which the system hopes to prevent this from happening lies in their trying to redirect violence, or, in other words, defuse the bomb. The main weapon they have to do this with is the infiltration of both sides of the radical sphere, black and white, and using the infiltrators to screw things up. Is this not what we've been reading about so often lately? But problem upon problem will compound for the Big Brother system, and the time will soon come when, first, he has trouble paying enough pimps to keep the revolutionary movement from climbing to its feet. And second, the time is going to come when few individuals will want to take that kind of chance, for any money, once infiltrators start being killed as soon as they are uncovered. The elements, already in motion and proceeding at the same pace along routes destined to converge at some future date, will come together suddenly. This year, it was reported in the system's media that 1980 saw no fewer than 9 major riots in large U.S. cities. But during 1980, I recall only one riot. Miami, reported as such by the media. So only in Miami was it called a riot in 1980. Sometimes it's difficult to tell exactly how far along things actually are at any given moment because of the controlled media. Big Brother will never allow Dan Rather to report that he is hanging on the ropes by his eyelids. Look at the situation in Britain. When that occurs on a comparative scale here, it will mean the end of the system. Media reports indicated only weeks ago that a dam was blown in New Jersey, already in critical shape for usable water, and resulted in the system's puppet in charge declaring a state of emergency. The balance the system maintains today is incredibly delicate and highly vulnerable to attack by just individuals. It isn't a case of kill or be killed. Instead, it is a matter of killing in preference to allowing death to win by default. I believe that, through past experience, by weighing in cause and effect, and by taking these incidents that have occurred over approximately the past year, we can estimate closely the timetable for the destruction of the system. The weakening of society, the increase in the number of those fighting for their life who step outside master's rules, what the blacks can be expected to do, almost universal apathy all the way to hostility toward the system among the masses, etc., will increase until the current balance becomes absolutely untenable. That's when all bets will be canceled, the gloves will come off, and helter-skelter will commence. those already dead in the Jews' money, and especially those now exercising power through the Jews' money, will fall like flies when, first, the system can no longer maintain artificially, as it does now, the hellish, unnatural life support of the megalopolis, which contain the bulk of the genetic morass and the clownish, or clonish, zombie-like lost whites, and second, with the money weapon having evaporated into thin air from their hands, the sold-out politicians and pigs become fair game for a population bent on bloodlust. Those who own the show today will go to their reward wondering why and how this could happen to them, how the tables could have turned so fast. The beginning is here, and few recognize it. The end will be even more unexpected. Volume 10, Number 8, August 1981. 2.34, Marked and Unmarked. It is well to follow earlier segments with a word on how a truly revolutionary organization must be structured in order to be effective. Those of us having in our innocent youth been part of the mass strategy, in quotes, find ourselves now and forever marked in the catalogs of the FBI, CIA, and ADL, not to mention local police departments. Unless we as individuals decide in our own minds to disappear and slip underground, alone to wage war against the system, on what would probably be a one-way mission, we would be foolish to try to engage directly in armed struggle. To do so in spite of this truth for purposes of proving something to somebody falls directly in line with one of the key Zionist protocols, which states that the white man's greatest undoing has been a willingness to sacrifice a larger goal for a smaller momentary one. We have absolutely no intention of rushing into their waiting open arms. And no, our new people will not be paraded out in the streets in useless Phase One antics for the convenience of the system's catalogers. Neither shall they be all monitored by post office checks of our mailings. Comrades of old, those of us already marked from years ago, who head the various cells around the country, will disseminate our propaganda person to person to those known only to themselves. Regarding Phase Two versus reality, these new people must not deliberately or at anyone's behest cause themselves to be separated from the mainstream of white America, either because of hairstyle, clothing, or any other stupid, narrow consideration. They must be able to move about freely, accepted and unnoticed by their fellows, if they are to be effective. Far from going out of our way to effect an invasion from Mars with Prussian tactics and appearance, as seemed to be the goal in years past, blowing minds, etc., we must effect a thorough infiltration, or at least be able to infiltrate at will, wherever and whenever the situation calls for it. Too many chiefs and no Indians has basically been the problem of the past. Those who insisted most loudly upon being chief in the past usually turned out to be the least fit to hold the position. A true soldier simply understands his mission, or duty, and goes about doing it without fanfare. Being revolutionary soldiers, we must do what we are able to do, and do well. We each have functions to fulfill. Circumstances, not wishful thinking, dictate these functions. As Joe Tomasi clearly stated, the leaders, the real chiefs, are those actually doing it. And we of the old school have been severely limited by the past itself. The greatest field of opportunities lies open to the newcomers, free of the hogwash, mistakes, and compromises of the past. However, one of the functions of the NSLF above ground is to see to it that the revolution, once begun in earnest, is not betrayed. Let's start off on that road now. Volume 9, Number 5, September 1980. 2.35, Behold the Uncle Tom. Recently we've seen two men of action brought to a halt by what are best referred to as white Uncle Toms. I believe it was a nurse at a blood bank who dime-dropped on Joseph Franklin when she saw and recognized from reports a distinctive tattoo on Franklin's forearm as he was selling blood. The system in Buffalo, there's another good reason not to get a tattoo. The system in Buffalo, New York, believes they now have the 22 killer in custody after he was fingered by someone in Georgia he evidently thought he could confide in. These were not cases of infiltration, but rather of carelessness playing into the hands of the countless millions of Uncle Toms who are what this society is made up of. The Big Brother system, of course, operates as the master, with a goyish, nominally white consumers serving as slaves, of which the vast bulk are dyed-in-the-wool Uncle Tom types. Both Franklin and the 22 Killer, or the Great White Hope of Buffalo, had it right, and were encouraging, at least insofar as they acted consistently alone, which is what solely provided the extent of success and longevity they did enjoy. We cannot forget the effect these men have had on helping to break the conditioned hothouse atmosphere and inject into the climate an air of revolution. NSLF knows that we must see the kind of society we are dealing with, understand it, and realize that it can't be changed unless and until the current order is done away with. Cognizant of all that, we then must make up our minds to proceed appropriately, allowing that both these men, heroes actually, made the errors which undid them by taking too much for granted. As a movement, we cannot afford the same mistakes twice. As individuals, we can't afford it even once. We can state again and again, never deal with the police, but you and I already know that. It is rather the rest of the total population which does not know it and never will know it, not even when the police have become our police. They will never change their habits. Today, the casual citizen informant, the Uncle Tom, works terribly against us, but tomorrow they will provide the greatest ease and benefit. It is their nature to bow, scrape, and try every means to ingratiate themselves with the established authority and to inform on those designated as outlaws. Miserable, unthinking swine. Today it is us, tomorrow it will be the race mixers, etc. Until we establish ourselves as the only authority, we must, as revolutionaries and realists, accept the bitter in anticipation of the sweet. It is a sad commentary on U.S. society when we compare to that of Northern Ireland. Not an informant in the bunch. And that struggle is white versus white. Over here we face the most odious enemy, posing as a government, ever in history, plus a monstrous black alien mass in our midst to be dealt with. Yet instead of Huey Long's concept of every man a king, it is rather every man an Uncle Tom. This armada of Uncle Toms is likened to the better half of the system police state already long in existence. Even with their incredibly sophisticated 1984 electronic surveillance techniques, the police simply could not function effectively without the citizenry working for Big Brother, against themselves. We could romp them if the whites of the United States were what they ought to be. But they are not, and never are they likely to be. Seeing we cannot change that, we must instead adapt our tactics accordingly. We must become acutely aware at all times of the most minute details around us, overlooking nothing, taking nothing for granted. We must rigidly discipline ourselves to never ever breathe a word about anything illegal to anyone, any time, past, present, or future. Don't talk. Defeat Uncle Tom. Defeat Big Brother. Volume 10, Number 6, June 1981. 2.36. Stupid people. Stupid people are more dangerous than any time bomb. You'll find stupid people everywhere. But let us confine ourselves to those within the movement itself, those whom we must deal with on a regular basis. Those armies of idiots within the system bureaucracy stand backed up and reinforced by so many replacements that errors of judgment on their part, which would otherwise prove fatal, are usually quickly caught and reversed before any real damage gets done. Oftentimes they are caught and squelched before anyone not part of the bureaucracy even can take note of them. It gives the aura of invincibility, but in fact provides for a deadly defect in that everyone is depending on everyone else to carry things through. There are plenty of sharpies within the system, but not the same kind as are found in revolutionary movements, those that can do it all for themselves. The system needs their stupid people for errand boys, etc., while we just cannot afford their presence at all. With us, things must stand or fall with just you and I. And that is the basis of real responsibility. Regardless whether they are with you or against you, stupid people are equally disastrous to have around. It is easy for anyone to imagine how stupid people can foul up the best plan or program and defeat the efforts of dozens of good and prudent people with whom they have associated themselves. But it is less easily understood what it means to have fools for adversaries. Again, I emphasize that we are dealing within the limits of the movement itself. I'd much rather run the risk of a tactical personal setback at the hands of a sharp, intelligent person, something I would expect I could reverse in time, than to have everything, the whole ball of wax, upturned or destroyed by some flake who loses all better judgment and control. The very reason one falls out with persons of limited intelligence usually involves the same lack of vision, imagination, and discipline that will later lead them to tip the balance over from a localized clash to a full-scale disaster, too often involving the system and threatening to destroy or seriously injure both participants. It's also hell to try to second-guess an unintelligent person. They are largely unpredictable and are liable to do anything. An intelligent adversary can most of the time be anticipated, and if not, it usually means that he is a jump or two ahead of you himself. He can be expected to fight things with at least the protection, if not the immediate furtherance of the cause in mind. A stupid individual won't care. They can see or understand nothing beyond the immediate object of, "I'll show you." How often have we witnessed this in right-wing dealings? How often have we seen it in personal affairs? And how the pigs laugh at it all. Within the movement, whenever a person like this is uncovered and proceeds to threaten to disrupt things, he properly should be killed before any damage can be done. If that is not feasible, then it is critical to place as much distance between them and the movement as possible. Same goes for personal dealings as well. Of course, in the long run, it is better to learn how to spot them in advance and never let them penetrate to a level where they can do no good and only harm. In this way, we shall forge ourselves into a truly formidable political weapon. That was Volume 13, Number 7, July 1984. 2.37. Brief your people. As we've said often enough in the past, not everyone is a leader type. Not everyone can be expected to do all the thinking all the time. If you are working with others, under whatever pretenses, it is a serious mistake to assume they will be able to think things through and make all the right moves under a sudden and stressful situation, such as a police attack, with no preparation. The only best way to prepare for such event, which you may safely assume will occur sooner or later, is by briefing your people in advance of any contingency. A briefing is just that. It is a going over, aloud, of only the essential points involved in any specific situation, only the crucial, critical facts and principles that are known to be involved. I personally have worked miracles through the successful use of briefings. A person totally unfamiliar to a given situation can be made to pass as being intimately familiar with it after a thorough briefing. And a thorough, successful briefing should require no more than 30 minutes time, maximum. Any more than that and you run the risk of confusing your people. At times I have taken people either by car or on foot from place to place while I have briefed them on the essentials and facts, and if there is a fabrication to be made, then that is to be injected after the known, indisputable facts have been introduced and established. The key is to remove all confusion and uncertainty. Avoid redundancy and concentrate upon making as many important impressions on the minds of your subjects as possible. Making them acquainted at first hand by sights and motions only aids in making those impressions. Once they grasp the workings and are aware of the facts, then most anything can be added, including extra events and even extra people. This, of course, comes in most handy when prepping or coaching witnesses before appearing under oath. When getting ready to head off a possible mess involving the law, as in the case concerning a revolutionary circle living and existing outside of legal bounds, briefings made well in advance of any expected investigation or attack, and rehearsed periodically, designed to delete certain group activities, are what is required. A successful briefing will never involve an attempted recital of a cut-and-dried script. To be credible, and thus to be effective in practical use, whether offensively or defensively, one's given story must flow naturally and show all the characteristics of a normal, relaxed conversation. It must never go in direct contradiction of the known facts, but instead merely present an unknown side of the story, basically in agreement with all the others. It must never include easily, readily demonstrable lies. Further, when under investigation or attack by any PIG agency of the system, it is of the utmost importance that everyone keep their stories straight. Consistency is one of the most basic keys to successful briefing. A shrewd individual will know how to brief his people so that the enemy will provide the cues for the prepared stories or answers. To be really successful at briefing people, you must make them able to recognize dangerous or trick questions when they are asked. Most generally, the appropriate answer will be only too obvious. With practice, all involved will get better. Briefing should properly provide what amounts to, quote, instant experience in whatever area it is you are going into. Its effect should be a building confidence within and robbing the enemy of any element of surprise. I've done this successfully with groups, with individuals, with the elderly, and with very small children. The object is always the same. Defeat the pig. Volume 13, number 7, July 1984. 2.38, Cooler Heads. With even the most minor experience within movement circles and activities, you yourself will probably be, in any given situation out of a tense nature, the coolest head present. Whenever the situation does become heated or aroused in any way, never assume that other cooler heads will prevail, for to do so runs the risk that the problem may escalate out of control, with you being right in the middle. Never forget the number one priority of any revolutionary: to maintain, to survive at all costs. We can't allow ourselves the luxury of common anger and the resultant outlets that such anger inevitably seeks and finds. If there's no clear-cut advantage to any potential conflict, then stay out of it. Head it off. Avoid it absolutely. Suicide pacts are of no use. Policies of mutual destruction are only feasible where huge resources exist. Punitive measures are currently an unaffordable expense for us. It is a mistake of the most childish sort to abandon for the greater good the higher goal in favor of pursuing some momentary thing involving some practically meaningless sidetrack. Whatever move you make, whether it involves punishing, leaving alone, or even rewarding any person or anything, make sure that it is so calculated that it is you and the movement who will ultimately profit from it. And it matters not whether you apply any one of the three options to the situation, where spur-of-the-moment emotion might want to apply another, just so long as you do not shoot yourself in the head, but rather emerge the final beneficiary of your own decision. It is here where supreme self-discipline is demanded. For the young revolutionary movement, the old concept of the Mexican standoff should become well understood. Whenever tangling with equal or superior force over some tributary or even lesser matter, you should consider yourself to be battling 1,000, or batting 1,000, if you can walk away from the situation alive, free, and intact, not to mention with the added experience which has cost you nothing. That is a definite victory of sorts. The Mexican standoff, therefore, is about the best we, in our limited and tedious position, can hope for. We must learn to be able to base all decisions and actions accordingly to our own benefit. The time for chest-thumping, false theatrics, and heroics is past. We must act prudently and wisely in each case, henceforth, if we are to be around and in the position to exercise genuine heroics when the actual day for them arrives. We must continue to survive until that day. Be assured, cooler heads will prevail. It is up to you to make certain that the cooler head belongs to you. Volume 13, number 7, July 1984. 2.39. Leaks. Paranoia is an insidious thing and must rank as one of the top two or three causes for the complete failure of racialist organization. Paranoia is most often thought of as seeing things which aren't there, infiltrators, Jews, etc., but it has one residual effect of not seeing things which really are there. We've all seen the instances of the racialist right-wing type who sees, and often goes on to create, an enemy in one or more movement comrades, but who falls blindly into government traps. A genuine leader type can and will override all human foibles and deficiencies and go on to wield an effective organization. In spite of surrendering to individual weaknesses, he will exploit the strengths and talents. The trick is that he himself must be smarter or made of better stuff than those he is trying to manage. Hitler was one. Rockwell was another. Hitler originally titled his autobiographical masterwork as A Struggle Against Lies, Stupidity, and Cowardice, thus almost surrendering to the temptation to lower oneself to the negativism which, admittedly, abounds. Fortunately, Hitler thought better of it in the end and gave us instead Mein Kampf, just My Struggle. Commander Rockwell publicly inveighed against right-wing divisiveness and privately complained about how it was eating up far too much of his time and energy and preventing the party from growing into what it should and could have become during his life under his leadership. But he stayed on the road and in the public eye, hard at work, building the political organization despite all. Or keep your eyes on the prize, as Jesse Jackson would say. Today, what passes as the movement lies at the total mercy of unbridled paranoia reaching back for an entire decade. Times and strategies have changed, or have had to be changed, to face present realities, and I've often enough in the past labored long over most things of an hallucinatory nature which have ripped the movement into shreds. Now perhaps is the time to discuss some of those things which are quite real, but have done almost as much damage simply because movement adherents have been too occupied with the unreal. The real threat to radical political organizations is always from government sources. After all, is it not the fear of the presence of government agents which leads to, or provides excuses, for those paranoid ones to label this or that hapless person an agent provocateur? But for every 10 persons so accused, only one turns out to be the real thing. And that is if he is ever uncovered as such. Most of the time, these agents simply gather their information and then disappear as quickly as they came, with no harm done. I've known the company of quite a few. The really classic example of an agent provocateur is, in fact, the one which only appears in the rarest of cases. He is the one who, through his skill and your carelessness, gets you and your associates locked up, injured, or killed. These agents are distinct from simple informants because they actually engineer things which otherwise would never happen. Commander Rockwell often said that both an idiot or an agent can get you just as dead or just as locked up, but if you can't determine the difference between the two, then be assured you'd be better off not aspiring to any movement leadership. The leaks which I'm talking about are not our leaks, that is, any holes in our security such as it is, but rather their leaks. Leaks in the secrecy of their blanket surveillance of us. And leaks in the effectiveness of it. Agents do exist, and if you stay at this long enough, active enough, you will run into your share of them. But regardless who you are and what role you may play in the movement, if your name so much as appears on a mailing list, then you too are part of this blanket surveillance, which extends over all the rest of us. About 1970, I was at a party in a rural county southeast of here, attended by a group of young persons of about my age, at that time, 18 years. One of them was the son of neighbors of ours down the country road where we'd moved from the city. After a few drinks, he approached me with, "How come the FBI is after you?" I told him I hadn't been aware that they were after me, whereupon he stated that two agents had been by his home and had asked certain questions about me of his parents, questions pertaining to certain nocturnal gatherings being held in my grounds lately and being pretty well attended by locals. I assured my friend that everything was all right, and laughed to myself at the idea of the FBI concerning itself over earlier drinking parties I had hosted, and which were made up of practically the identical cast that was present that evening. This, to the FBI, was a Nazi rally, if I was the one hosting it. Wouldn't the guests have positively crapped, had they but known? In 1975, when I first emerged from a 6 months in jail, having been convicted of a criminal charge, as this country has no political prisoners, I sent for and obtained my FBI file. At that time it amounted to a mere 50 pages, but it was notable that it extended back into my high school days, with information having been supplied by former friends and associates as well as parents of same, and amounting to no more and no less than hearsay and rumor. 1975 was also the year I broke from the former National Party and became active in my own right. 3 years later, In 1978, I again requested my updated FBI file and was told that it now amounted to 2,500 pages. 50 pages accumulated from 1966 to 1974, including 3 years off and on at National Headquarters, and 2,500 pages from 1975 to 1978. That tends to speak for itself, except that the vast bulk of what was contained in those pages is useless garbage, and again, rumor. Specifics, such as the identities of agents, informants, etc., were blacked out, but by reading around the omitted parts, one had no difficulty in determining who the informants were. During 1974, the Ross County unit of the party was engaged in a legal fight to secure the county's first openly Nazi booth at a county fair. With the help of the ACLU, we succeeded in doing just that. As this is a small town and, quote, things like that just don't happen around here, the air was tense that entire summer. I recall one evening picking up my telephone to make a routine call, first to hear no dial tone, and next overhear open-ended conversation in the background. Conversation which, after a few moments of listening to, was determined to be originating from the Chillicothe City Hall and Police Station. That's in Ohio. And at about that same time after the incident, came the incident after I had cashed a few minor checks from party headquarters at my customary booth for the purchase of licenses necessary for the fair booth, when the rumor came back to me that I was, quote, being bankrolled by the Nazis. If only it could have been true. It was during about 1977 that I received in my P.O. box a letter from the secretary of a California comrade, a major movement leader at that time. The envelope was unmarked. There was no return address save for the postmark itself, and the only things correct in the address were my name and the state of Ohio. The box number, the name of the city, and even the zip code were all wrong, not even close. Yet the letter made it to me all safe and sound. Rod Serling, move over. Twilight Zone. Then there have been certain actions here locally which, had the police but intervened in them, could have put myself and a few others away on some heavy charges. These involved matters ranging from the illegal to the quasi-legal, but which contained too many legalistic red tape complications to be comfortable with in any case. Some had to do with planned physical attacks in broad daylight in public, while others involved forays into surrounding counties to spread the revolutionary word, and involving trespassing, minors, etc. We were told that these cities' police departments requested of the one locally to please either stop us from doing this or at least tip them as to when we were on our way. They failed to do either. There was the flight I had to make from Ohio in 1981 when a warrant for my arrest appeared imminent. There was no difficulty in getting out. Evidently, they weren't watching closely at these times, or else they didn't want to move until they felt sure they could put me away for good. More recently, I was told by an amused ex-girlfriend last year that during the course of a conversation at a social gathering attended by herself and some local attorneys, etc., plus one out-of-state government man, it was dropped by this out-of-towner that there was one local name on this list of, quote, dangerous persons to watch, mine. And presently, there was a call from one ex-associate about a month ago to the effect that I was, quote, about to take a fall. According to him, rumors emanating from sources both official and private were too many to be ignored. Illegal possession of certain material was at the bottom. He advised me to get rid of it, if indeed it existed at all, and I assured him, no problem. And to date, no raid. With the single exception of the last account, none of the above was ever, at any time, discussed over the telephone, through the mail, or with any person not immediately involved with the issue at hand. And persons involved were kept to a strict minimum. As Commander Rockwell advised in his masterful legal, psychological, and political warfare, you must assume that you are being watched and listened to at all times and proceed to act accordingly because, in effect, you are. The degree and intensity of this surveillance rises or falls hand in hand with the degree of revolutionary political activity you maintain. Mine has always been pretty intense in the past, but I've always found there to be leaks aplenty in Big Brother's fearsome apparatus. Leaks in his supposed steel wall of covert secrecy. Leaks in his supposed airtight coverage of everything we say and do. Most importantly, these leaks can be anticipated and even engineered by you for revolutionary advantage if only you discipline yourself and rid your mind of deadly paranoia, which, far from protecting you from Big Brother's agents, actually does about 80% of their work for them. That was volume 13, number 12, December 1984. 2.40. There was no time to say goodbye. You can't exist in the middle of an embryonic revolutionary movement and expect to live trouble-free indefinitely. We around here never did. At present, if the system decided upon one big midnight raid on all known movement members, he'd probably make his bag with little difficulty, and that is because we are nowhere nearly enough prepared defensively. But then neither are we properly prepared offensively, and so Big Brother is not likely to be contemplating such a strike. I'm speaking instead of the kind of situation where there exists the immediate threat of arrest and/or jail for a so-called criminal violation, which on the surface would appear, legally and otherwise, to have no political connection. That, as all of you should be aware, remains our number one threat individually, as it has been for 20 years. What would you do this minute if you were made aware that an arrest might be imminent? Not the kind of arrest that could be seen as the system versus the movement, but merely as the police against you. Would you, could you, leave your home, your family, immediately? Do you have dependable transportation readily available? Do you have safe accommodations nearby which you can depend on without notice? Do you have safe accommodations out of state which are likewise dependable without advance notice? How about out of the country if necessary? Do you have lines of communication back home which can act as your eyes or ears in your absence? Do you know which foreign governments and how to approach them might offer aid and sanctuary should you have to depart permanently? Could you and would you go if you had to, or would you be caught flat-footed, paralyzed by terror and indecision, without instant recourse? If your answer to any one of these questions except the last one is no, then I suggest that you take steps to correct the situation while you still can. Your liberty may depend on it. Forget a glorified, dramatized, civil guerrilla war in which hundreds or thousands are involved. In more or less normal times, could you, on a one-to-one basis, evade the damn police if you had to? Just pick up and go on a few precious moments' notice. If not, you're living under a deadly disadvantage and possibly fatal handicap. We were suddenly faced with this very thing here and managed to pass the test. Our lines of communication discovered afterward, once we were out of reach and safe, that the situation was one which could be controlled or at least looked to be a decent enough gamble and not a one-way ticket to who knows where. We're back in the saddle now and making our moves. Whatever the outcome of that, it afforded a priceless and 100% realistic dry run for what can happen in life under a police state, in life in the reality of revolution, and not the fantasy of books. I urge all of you to think about it. Then act. Volume 10, number 6, June 1981. 2.41, Off My Case. Don't confuse this with the spectacle of the right-wing joker who stages a press conference to announce the formation of a secret underground guerrilla army. This only involves you and nobody else but you. I've never been accused of being a paranoid individual, of imagining things which aren't there. My desire to be aware of what the hell I'm doing and what's going on around me precludes that. Earlier I wrote a segment entitled Leaks, in which I partially delved into what I'm about to discuss, except then it was to demonstrate a different point. At that time I was concerned with the range and the limits of system surveillance of ourselves. This time, however, I want to discuss definite ways in which we can actually control and turn to our own use the things I revealed in Leaks. Every time I pick up one of those exposés of the movement done by the ADL, etc., it appears to me as though they are invariably about 3 years behind the times as far as who's who and what's what. There can be no doubt that this constitutes for us an advantage in itself, however accidental it may be or unintentional on our part. Clearly, it would seem that the desirable thing to do would be to take it upon ourselves, individually, to make sure that the gap in current, accurate information gets even wider. Unless you are a publicity hound or an exposure freak, it shouldn't prove too hard at all to leave an icy cold trail. The point being that you can do a hell of a lot more in anonymity by way of things which count than you could ever hope to do under any kind of official or semi-official scrutiny. It is never necessary to foolishly attempt to deny or otherwise disown the movement or any part of it. Far from putting distance between it and yourself, that only amounts to another kind of grandstanding and draws more attention, the wrong kind of attention. Morally, politically, ethically, who gives a damn? Rather, it is in whether or not you are a person who bears a lot of watching, and two, whether or not you're the type of person who demands to be watched. The best example of this is in the legal demonstration. There you are, in the middle of the spotlight, in the middle of a country full of people who not only don't give a damn, but who also hate shit disturbers. You might prove some kind of point which says something about yourself, but you've done nothing which affects them, except to put them on notice, giving them something to wag their tongues about in bottomless ignorance. Morally, you may have accomplished something very significant, but if it had been at any time a question of morals, we'd have won the Second World War. Perhaps at bottom the sad fact is that it's dangerous and counterproductive, as well as futile, for us to attempt to communicate in any way with the people of this country. When has it gained anything for us? Those who have come to us have done so because of some inner calling of their own. So it shall continue, I suspect. And here you see really the pre-internet ideas. That would change radically with the internet. Joseph Tomasi in 1975 declared the closing of the strategy of mass movement and opened the way for the armed struggle. Have things been developing in this way ever since, or have they not? I merely propose to increase this division and intensify its development for the good of us all. No stunts, no handstands, no fanfare. Instead, care and caution, long-range planning. When you strike, strike hard and strike deep. Play for keeps. But always in the end, it's a matter of greater steady mileage over intense but short bursts. Don't attract needless attention. Volume 14, number 10, October 1985. 2.42, Survivalism. I don't pretend to be an expert on the art of surviving under very primitive or hostile conditions. Yet, aren't we all doing that very thing when you really consider it? And more so all the time as this civilization continues to rot away? Despite the erroneous image some have in their minds of what the NSLF is or is supposed to be, few of us, in fact, could qualify as guerrillas. But probably the biggest difference between one of us and a real guerrilla is all the Hollywood-style phony image-making, plus the fact that we aren't little boys out to play army, but instead revolutionaries who must pick and choose our means as the case warrants. Primarily, we're not off on any trip, and as real and valuable as survival precautions and techniques are, when made into a hobby or an obsession, they become an actual trip. We are realists, and as such we view these things merely as part of the weapons arsenal, not as central to the issue, much less the issue itself. We are the first to tell you to be prepared, but we are also the first to tell you never to get sidetracked. The talk of survivalism is now everywhere. It's not a bad thought, but I see that the profiteers have moved in, including those non-political, non-racialists, and even many who are part of the establishment. Whenever this phenomenon occurs, you can be sure that the thing is deliberately being overdone and is well on its way to being run straight into the ground. It is today's fad. And whenever the establishment feels secure enough to dabble around in something, you can be pretty sure that it is in no way very valuable to the struggle we must fight. What about all those bomb shelters of the 1950s? And what are those hidden weapons caches of the 1960s? No Russian bombs, no federal swoops. What about even all the tremendous harum scarum of the Red-inspired marches and demonstrations of the 60s and 70s? No Red Revolution in the streets of the U.S., merely the latest thing to get spooky right-wingers vibrating and shucking out vast amounts of loot. But then the NSLF and Siege hammer away about the impending collapse and even the necessity of such a collapse before anything good can be accomplished. A contradiction? Not really. It has been stated before that very few things in this world are in plain black and white, and this includes any sort of national collapse. We are in fact in a state of collapse now. We are indebted to a real slime dripper, former New York City Mayor John Lindsay, for providing us with this beautiful and accurate simile. The crime rate alone in this country is equal to a nationwide, nonstop, quote, riot in slow motion. If it hasn't already passed the point of total ridiculousness, it will any second now. But that is beside the point. The right, and people in general, Think only in terms of the melodramatic, the stereotypical. This, however, has been proven enough times to be what the expected case will not be, that we in the movement should know better. They can't seem to see a leader. They're scared to death whenever one of us pulls a revolutionary act, and yet they think in these grandiose patterns of things happening in a big, overwhelming way. They cannot seem to think and see in terms of stages and degrees, which is precisely how the enemy advances. Survivalism for the realist can be bound up in only a few very basic common-sense principles. First, remove yourself from what I call the death zones, which are simply the metropolitan areas of the country. In these places, not only is Big Brother's grip the tightest, but the lowest common denominator, genetic miasma, has you badly outnumbered. The air and water are going fast, many of the so-called whites still there are totally gone to degeneracy, and life itself is already abnormal, a mutation of whatever it once was. There is no hope for these places whatsoever, under any circumstances, so get the hell out now while the getting is still good. Second, get located in an area where self-support can be possible, an area where you can successfully survive and survive white as a separate region in the event of a complete national breakdown and protracted chaos. Let the cities go to hell right where they came from. If the Russians don't get them, and if crime, famine, and disease don't get them, then we'll have to later on. Third, on an individual level, you must have all set up and ready to go, independent sources of water, food, and heat. At the same time, you must have weapons and sufficient stores of ammunition with which to defend yourself. All of the above is basic essential. None of it is wild or exotic. The above is simply a way to live, a habit to get into. At the same time, it doesn't interfere with one's daily business or daily living. It doesn't make you weird. But you'd be amazed at the number of those who fall flat in all three of those categories. They are not going to survive. More than what I've outlined is optional. For example, some advanced essentials would have to include medical supplies and independent communication sources. The actual organizing of neighbors into tight-knit communities and defense units is a tough one to accomplish. To go any further here would be to depart from reality, because I know human nature and the laziness and never-neverland mentality of the right wing. They won't do it because they don't have the scope of imagination or the long-range gumption. I speak only about what you can and should do. The danger in survivalism lies in the fallacy of the hobbyist escapist's own private dream world. Most imagine that blowing exorbitant sums on the supposed trappings of the professionals, or the accumulation of a library of doomsday manuals, or even the acquisition of a monstrous personal armory means survival. But are they living in a metro area? Are there hundreds of thousands of undesirable humans only blocks away? Do they have a good well? Wood-burning heat and adequate fuel? Can they grow or hunt food? Are they a likely target in the event of a nuclear war? To me, survival and reality are the same. Phony, faddish survivalism is nothing more than a hobby, and hobbyism is nothing more than escapism. But admittedly, escapism appears to be part and parcel of the movement as it stands. Useless and expensive hobbies won't make it. It's all the same if you remained hooked up to Big Brother's life support system. If you are, you will get disconnected with the rest and sink with the ship. This phony survivalism appears to be the most elaborate yet of all the dished up excuses for inaction and retreat. It's another way to build yourself an expensive sandcastle. There is a clear path to survival, just as there is a clear path to victory. Both involve being in touch with reality and in taking action in going forward. Volume 10, Number 10, October 1981. 2.43, Readying for Revolution. The mood of much of the population and the state of the economy both indicate that everyone could have a surprise in store for them at practically any time. Belief in the rottenness of the system, coupled with a belief in ourselves and in our power to make revolution, will guarantee that, even if we are surprised by any suddenness of events, we will not be found unprepared and helpless to become victims rather than masters. At present, the worst enemies of a revolution happening in America are the unbroken sway of the system's thought control, i.e. the mass media, and the continued existence of this economy, as agonizing as it is, protracted and miraculous. In short, the system survives and functions so people are not allowed to think, to know, plus they can still be alternately rocked to slumber or subtly coerced into inaction. Our agenda at present, then, as indicated by the prevailing conditions, would include focusing all our concentration on the ideological swing from reaction all the way over to total revolution. In other words, effecting a revolution within our existing movement first. Learning rapidly to live outside of the economy and live off of the system in order to help hasten its demise and to ensure our own survival, whether there remains a month or 20 years left to this state of affairs. Getting away from metropolitan areas and quickly establishing solid, independent enclaves for ourselves and our families. Practicing both a subtle and overt undermining of native faith in the existing government or system on the part of the people around us, not as radicals, but as friends and leaders for the future, and having prudent stocks of weapons and sufficient stores of ammunition. Going overboard in quantities or in grossly exotic and illegal weaponry is a serious blunder. Concentrate on safe refuge and let all words and actions go toward undermining the system and toward strengthening the revolution. In the future, at any time, the best friends of a revolution in this country will be any worsening or collapse of the economy, along with any large-scale disaster, disruption, or upheaval from any source. We want, first, for the system to crap out before one and all, so that the evil Ginny, the illusion that's been holding it together for these past decades, will once and for all be dispelled. We want its pimps to be deprived of their entire purpose, their entire excuse for living, as well as their protection, which depends completely on this economy's survival. And we especially want to see the system and its hired hoods under attack by the identical forces they created and unleashed upon our segment of the population as part of their master plan of control. We want to see the system's strength and structure largely destroyed, initially by forces independent of our own. Only at that time will we be able to begin undertaking bold and sweeping actions toward assuming control for ourselves. By that time, and it could come much sooner than anyone expects, we will absolutely need to have a strong and well-functioning revolutionary organization already operational and with a full spectrum of direct experience under its belt. It is in this area and nowhere else that the breakthrough must be made, the area of revolutionary organization. Without it, the revolution must go to someplace else, to someone else who does possess the strength of discipline and the will necessary to move and achieve it. First and last, the responsibility is entirely ours. Volume 14, number 12, December 1985. 2.44, in reverse, again. Not long ago, I took a close look at the way the movement has been in the habit of doing things, everything from the lowliest task to the most critical one, and discovered that they tended to do it in a bass-ackwards way every time. As I said, this can be applied to just about all aspects of activity, but it is still necessary to take a look at each one individually in order to see the significance of this. One of the areas is that of the overtly illegal, violent attacks against the system. Hit and run, so to speak. Wouldn't it make better sense to turn that concept around to run and hit? It only means that you should first drop out of sight, go underground, and stay that way for however long is required for you to learn to exist comfortably at it. At that point, you can go ahead and do, and probably get away with, any damn thing you'd choose to pull. Striking in hot passion and then running blindly is no more than glorified suicide. That was Volume 15, Number 1, January 1986. 2.45, Fury Unfelt. Through a former associate's job contacts, I once wound up invited to a meeting of the Revolutionary Communist Party. This particular cell was organized in a major factory here in Ohio, and this special meeting was being called as a result of one RCP member having been shot after the RCP had abandoned labor union discipline in fighting management ripoffs. They wanted to try and decide what to do, and they broke down and invited us, two known Nazis, to their gathering. It was convened in the home of the local organizer, Seth Goldberg. Included were Goldberg's Jewish girlfriend, showing plenty of thigh throughout, plus a handful of blacks and a handful of washed-out whites. The history leading up to the shooting, as well as the details of the shooting itself, were gone over for the sake of newcomers. My partner at the time, an old right-wing organizer who worked at the same plant, gave the young Reds some sound advice on how to get their act together, but nothing was actually resolved. Flabbergasted, I had to speak up and tell Goldberg that, were Trotsky present at this meeting, he'd puke his guts out. A general strike would go for openers. Then the bosses would be shot and the plant itself be blown up. Seth had no comment. Ironically and by accident, within the week, my partner, who had been illicitly using the company Xerox, or photocopy machine, left an original copy of Joseph Tomasi's famous political terror leaflet in the machine. The next day, there were double-armed guards at all factory gates. Point being that everybody is just blowing smoke, just pussyfooting around, even the communists. The riots of the 60s barely scratched the surface in the amount of direct, coordinated violence and terror that's going to be required to intimidate and melt the system. Volume 15, Number 1, January 1986. 2.46. When to shoot. Talk of weapons aside, this has to do with shooting the enemy. You don't need an arsenal for that. All you need is a zip gun and, most of all, the balls to use it. As I said earlier, if you're thinking about going on the warpath in the literal sense, you'd better take the time and planning to quietly drop underground first. Get yourself as comfortable and secure as you can, and only then start taking your actions against the system. Your chances of success and survival will go way up as opposed to those who shoot first and try to think afterward. But now we're talking future tense. Our revolution will depend on someone or something else kicking events off the edge and into the general chaos so as to loosen up some elbow room for the rest of us. It could be the blacks. It could be anything from a sudden depression to an earthquake. Just anything to get the pigs of the Big Brother system tied down and off balance. But just as we can't expect to accept the full brunt of a system counterattack starting things off by ourselves, neither can we expect, as avowed revolutionaries, to be left alone by the system once someone else has started the ball rolling. We must assume they are going to take certain measures to guard their rear. Those already underground or in prison will find this one to be a moot issue, but the rest of us still at liberty, and particularly those maintaining homes, etc., will probably have a unique set of difficulties to face when the time comes for general action. It's a matter best given a lot of thought now, as there will be no time for thought when it presents itself. Three contingencies we can look for will be the following. A. Once major and widespread revolutionary violence starts, no matter from what quarter, the system can be expected to detain all known revolutionists as a matter of precaution. B. Once the economy starts to fall rapidly, the system can be expected to begin mass foreclosures and confiscations while it feels it still can. C. Just like what's predicted to happen when the sun itself is about to burn out, the system, when it senses its time is about up, can be expected to begin taking a great many extraordinary steps, and in general, to really begin overstepping its bounds as they are vaguely defined today. Or hadn't you thought of any of this? The whole point to our being constrained to taking a backseat to someone else's opening gambit with regard to violent revolution is that we simply cannot stand to take on the full weight of the system's pigs now or in the foreseeable future. It will be rather a judgment call for the individual, once large-scale actions have begun, as to whether he thinks he can get away with his own line of extraordinary measures when confronted by the system in a threatening manner. How much you think you're worth to them, or how many backups they have to send after you, will be something that each in his own area will have to decide, and decide intelligently before he acts. You must remember that they are still used to having people, especially whites, drop over dead at their mere approach. Unfortunately, but quite likely, they'll still be thinking that way when they come after us, once someone else has started the shooting. Otherwise, they'd either not come at all, or else come with a small army behind them. This unquestionably would then leave the ball in our court as to how to react when only a few of them show up for what they expect to be a routine roust. Your choice will be either to let them take you into custody, away from your family, and possibly take your home and possessions too, or to take a chance on stopping them at that point and burying their bodies in the hills or being killed yourself. As I said, it'll be a judgment call, but one that takes some consideration, if not a considerable bit of preparation, in the present. That was Volume 15, Number 2, February 1986. And with that, we end the second chapter on armed revolution. Chapter 3 will be on National Socialism. Anyway, I want to thank you for being with me today, and I'll be back with you with more from James Mason's Siege real soon.